cannot say that for sure his lineage goes back to Abu Sufyan, and this point is not mentioned in authentic sources. And he might be called Sufyani because of the fact that, as I mentioned, his feature is like that of Abu Sufyan. Mm-hmm. He is opposing the truth, like Abu Sufyan, who for many years was one of the main enemies of the Prophet. He was opposing the Prophet even after apparently he converted to the religion of Islam, but he continued to
oppose him.
Exactly, oppose him, and even after the demise of the Prophet.
Yeah.
So the same is true about Sufyani. At the time of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, he will do his best to oppose Imam Mahdi alayhi salam and to defeat him. And that is why this is, of course, at least a possibility that he is called Sufyani, because he is like Abu Sufyan.
Okay.
But is he from the same lineage? At least we cannot say that this is something for sure. No, we do not have any authentic narration talking proof about this point. But again, I try my point that people will not have any problem in realizing Sufyani, and we are not in need of knowing the lineage because of the fact that we will know Sufyani through the actions that he will do,
mm-hmm,
and through the other signs which are mentioned to be happening at the same time, like that of Yamani,
yeah,
and Khorasan.
Yeah, so thank you so much, Dr. Karimi. We came to the conclusion that it's not very important what is his name or what is his lineage, but it's for sure that, yes, his features are like that of Abu Sufyan. So maybe we could say to some extent that he's from the lineage of Abu Sufyan, but not very surely, but not very sure about the fact. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much for providing us so much information that I have been always making notes of your sayings and saving them. And my friends are also doing that. Thank you so much for providing us with that important knowledge about the Imam of the time, which is neat. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Patrice Lumumba, the Congo's Prime Minister.
Part 1.
On August 6, 1945, some eyewitnesses were cited as saying that they had seen another sun rising in Japanese sky. There was no second sun. It was the U.S. first nuclear bomb, codenamed Little Boy, that was exploded at an altitude of 576 meters above the ground over the city of Hiroshima. 3 days later, the U.S. second nuclear bomb, nicknamed Fat Man, was dropped on the people of the city of Nagasaki to once again show off America's nuclear capability to the world and its East rival. However, the U.S. Army's show of power in the last days of the Second World War resulted in the killing of 220,000 Japanese civilians. The energy emitted from the explosion of Little Boy was estimated to equal a blast caused by 16,000 tons of TNT. A horrific bomb that the Americans managed to build only because they had got access to large uranium deposits. The country through which the required uranium to build these two bombs was provided lied in the heart of the African continent and was known as the Belgian Congo. June the 30th, 1960, the people of the Congo officially celebrated independence from Belgian colonialism. High-ranking officials from the Congo and other African countries attended the official independence ceremony. The event had a special guest. The Belgian king came to the Congo to give the gift of independence to the people of the country. In the ceremony, the king hailed the unwavering and wise sacrifices made by Belgium's former king and the founder of the Congo's colonialism, Leopold II, and lauded his efforts to civilize and liberate the people of the Congo from the yoke of colonialism. After the Belgian king's speech, Congolese President Joseph Kasavubu took the podium. But the story did not end there. Although the Prime Minister's speech was not on the agenda, Patrice Lumumba took the podium after President Kasavubu. The participants' stunned look at the Prime Minister had only one meaning. Patrice Lumumba was a dead Prime Minister now. The Congo is so rich in natural resources and vast deposits of mineral that it can be called a treasure island in the heart of Africa. Rivers, dense rainforests, diverse animal species, and unique underground resources, including copper, gold, uranium, coltan, and diamond, and in most cases, there is no other known example in our world to rival them. Despite its huge natural wealth, the Congo is among the world's poorest nations. This contradiction is rooted in successive calamities aimed at looting the Congo's natural treasures throughout history, which were endured by the people of this country. The crisis broke out when a white European decided to civilize the people of the Congo. In the late 19th century, Belgian King Leopold II sought to keep up with European neighbors. He had to find a colony to remain in the race. Most of the world's regions that were rich in resources had been already seized by competitors at the time. Africa was the only viable option. Sponsored by Sir Henry Morton Stanley, one of his friends, Leopold tried to find a suitable land as his colony. As an explorer in the heart of Africa, Stanley traveled along the Congo River and purchased land for the Belgian king after negotiating with African tribal chiefs. He bought the lands at a very low price, for example, in exchange for some clothes. So, in the early 1880s, Leopold could turn a land spanning as much as 900,000 square miles, that is 87 times the size of Belgium, into personal property. In 1884, the U.S. became the first country to recognize Leopold's sovereignty over the Congo. Leopold took advantage of this opportunity and officially claimed Belgium's sovereignty over the Congo. The shadows of Belgium's colonialism continued to affect the people of the Congo 8 years later and even after Leopold's death. The Congo's indigenous people were exploited as slaves in the country's mines, where they extracted their country's natural resources for the Belgians. The indigenous workers' wives and children were taken hostage to be subjected to harassment and even sexual abuse if the indigenous man refused to work, and they were sometimes murdered. At that time, one of the most common punishments for disobedience was to cut off the two hands. Although the Belgian government made extensive efforts to conceal its crimes in the Congo and even destroyed certain documents and reports, the articles that were published years later by Western journalists about that era revealed that as many as half of the Congo's population had been killed during Leopold's 40-year rule, which amounts to a massacre of tens of millions of people. The days of independence dawned after years of fighting by the people of the Congo. During the battle, the voice that was more vociferous than those of others belonged to a good-looking, determined young man named Patrice Lumumba. He wanted to obliterate the legacy of Leopold, which continued to haunt his country. Lumumba was imprisoned for his anti-colonialism activities for a while, but he was elected as leader of the Congolese National Movement in 1958. A movement led by the young Lumumba, which managed to overcome ethnic and tribal differences and revive the spirit of national unity and independence seeking among millions of the Congolese people. Heading a delegation, Lumumba went to Brussels and took part in Congolese independence talks. The negotiations resulted in holding the first free elections in the country. The result of the election stunned many, including Belgian colonialists. The MNC party won the election and Patrice Lumumba became the prime minister. Lumumba's government took office on June the 24th, 1960. He invited all people, even white Belgians, to unity to build a Congo. However, his Independence Day speech worried all those who had a vested interest in the Congo. The Prime Minister did not have to deal with the Belgians only because other powers like the UK and the US had gotten involved in the Congo as well. Lumumba's remaining in power as Prime Minister could pose a big challenge to those countries' growing interests. In August, the CIA station in the Congo sent a telegram to Washington that stated, quote, "Embassy and station believe the Congo experiencing classic communist effort to take over government," unquote. The message was addressed to CIA Director Alan Dulles, who had already managed to overthrow popular governments, including the one led by Mossadegh in Iran and Arbenz's government in Guatemala. Dulles warned the U.S. government against catastrophic consequences of communists' encroachment in the Congo, which could likely pose a threat to the free world's interests. On August 18, 1960, President Eisenhower told Dulles that the U.S. needed to do everything it could to remove Lumumba from power. Dulles sent a cable to Lawrence Devlin, the CIA's Congo station chief, ordering him to take more aggressive yet clandestine measures to that goal. The first coup plot in the Congo was hatched with the help of the U.S. Western allies. The state of Katanga was a rich mining region in the Congo, which had large deposits of copper, cobalt, uranium, and gold. Moise Tshombe, an old friend of Western multinational corporations, was the president of the state. Katanga proclaimed its independence and secession from the Congo only 11 days after the country's independence and staged rebellion against the central government and Prime Minister Lumumba himself. It is worth mentioning that as much as Moise Tshombe was pro-Western, he had a strange grudge against Lumumba.
These first films taken from behind Katanga lines show Katangese soldiers fighting through the streets.
As the first step, Belgium immediately backed Katanga's independence proclamation. The situation was worsening, and Patrice Lumumba needed extra help to deal with Katanga's separatist forces. Lumumba knew well that his Western enemies accuse him of supporting the Eastern Bloc. However, he did not ask for the Soviets' help, although they were famous for supporting anti-West reformist movements. He instead sought the U.S. help. But under the pretext of avoiding a conflict with the Soviets, the U.S. ambassador proposed that the Congo should ask for help from the U.N. Therefore, upon a request from Lumumba's government, UN Blue Helmets arrived in Leopoldville and were deployed to some regions, including Katanga. But these forces failed to carry out an effective measure to counter Katanga's separatists. To get more help to counter rebel forces as well as Belgium's military interventions, the Prime Minister headed to the White House without an official invitation. Against all his expectations, the U.S. did not welcome him. Certain American newspapers called him the dictator of the forest, and American officials refused to provide any sort of assistance to the Congo's democratically elected Prime Minister to resolve the country's problems. Fifteen years later, the U.S. Senate launched extensive investigations into interference of the CIA and the U.S. government in the Congo. The probe was led by Senator Frank Church. According to the reports of the Church Committee, the then U.S. president had issued a direct order to the CIA to assassinate Lumumba, and the CIA had launched a plot to eliminate the Congo's prime minister. To achieve this goal, two projects were put on the agenda. One of the projects was proposed by Joseph Schneider, a CIA scientific assistant. According to Schneider's project, a lethal virus indigenous to the Congo had to be administered to Lumumba in any possible way. In the second project, Dr. Sidney Gottlieb injected a lethal poison into toothpaste that was sent for Lumumba in a diplomatic package. But memoirs of the CIA station in the Congo said American spies in the Congo failed to carry out the operation. As the toothpaste passed its expiration date and was in fact useless, the evidence of crime was dumped in the Congo River. After Lumumba was disappointed about receiving any aid from the U.S., he had no choice but to appeal to the East superpower. Unlike the U.S., the Soviets welcomed the Congo government this time. Lumumba's government needed air transport to dispatch its forces to the state of Katanga. The Soviets provided the Congo government with their aircraft to transfer forces. Relative peace was restored to Katanga. However, the Soviets' assistance provided the best excuse for the U.S. to launch more covert propaganda against Lumumba.
At his news conference, President Eisenhower faces squarely the Congo crisis, which he feels is aggravated by the Soviet Union's intervention by sending planes, technicians, and arms.
The United States deplores the unilateral action of the Soviet Union in supplying aircraft and other equipment for military purposes to the Congo, thereby aggravating an already serious situation which finds Africans killing other Africans.
Now they could pin the label of communist on Lumumba and his government. The Americans use this weapon in the best possible way. At the same time, CIA agents transferred new eavesdropping devices to control and anticipate Lumumba's next moves and carried them to the Prime Minister's office through their Belgian friends. All the Prime Minister's contacts and communications came under the CIA surveillance. As the Congo was engulfed in chaos, Congolese President Joseph Kasavubu removed Lumumba from power in a dismissal order on September the 5th, just 74 days after the central government had taken office. A decision that the Prime Minister refused to accept. Lumumba went to the parliament and tried to dismiss President Kasavubu. He delivered such a fervent and reasonable speech that both the Senate and the National Assembly voted in favor of Lumumba. Under such circumstances, the Prime Minister needed to win the global public opinion, so he held a news conference with international journalists to inform the world of his stances. But some of these newspapers described him as Africa's Lenin.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of iRib English Radio Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hojjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned. It is related to be humble and courteous in the religion of Islam. In better words, a pious person in Islam is surely a humble one. Now, being humble means to lower yourself before both Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the people who are the creatures of Allah. These two must come together.
¶¶
بعضیا در برابر خلق خدا کوچیکی میکنن ولی در برابر خدا کوچیکی بگی.
Now there are some people who are humble before the people. However, they are not humble before Allah. Such people are not humble or courteous. They are traders or merchants. They like to trade and earn worldly benefits. That's why they show humbleness before people, but not before Allah. They bow before people so that people show more respect for them. This is a type of fake humbleness. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Fortress Europe is cruel, misguided, and doomed to fail. This is what experts call the European immigration system. And of course, taller, longer, and more high-tech walls will not solve the present problem of the Europeans, and the money could be far better spent. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Truth Out wrote in this regard, "It's time to rethink EU migration policy. New walls are being built in Europe, but they will not solve the present crisis, and the money could be far better spent. Instead, Serbia is constructing a fence on its border with North Macedonia and plans another to prevent crossings from Bulgaria. Greece is planning to extend its high-tech 40-kilometer-long, 5-meter-high steel, concrete, and barbed wire fence on the border with Turkey by a further 140 kilometers. Over the past 2 years, Poland, Lithuania, and Latvia have fortified their borders with Belarus by erecting fences of steel and barbed wire at a cost of more than €500 million. Several years earlier, Hungary spent €1.64 billion erecting steel and razor wire barriers on its borders with Serbia and Croatia. Around 1,800 kilometers of border walls and fences have been built on the perimeter of the EU in the past decade. The hefty prices include cameras, heat sensors, drones, armed vehicles, and guards to patrol and keep the outsiders out, as well as the cost of reduced trade between neighbors and damaged wildlife. The new militarized borders are intended to slow down the inflow of irregular migrants entering the EU from the east along the Western Balkan route. Over 228,000 undocumented asylum seekers from the West Asia, North Africa and Asia entered the EU last year, half of them along the Balkan route. That was a substantial increase on 2021, sparking fears of another refugee crisis similar to the one that sent a million undocumented refugees to the EU in 2015 to 2016. Yet, these expensive walls are unlikely to stop the refugees. If the wall can't be scaled with ladders, it can be walked around. The wall on the Polish-Belarusian border may be 186 kilometers long, but that leaves 232 kilometers of the border unfenced. Nevertheless, these longer walls do force would-be migrants to take more dangerous routes. They also permit higher profits for smugglers and traffickers of people, for example. Even though fewer refugees were apprehended in Hungary after the fence was built, the number of human smugglers arrested increased, and thousands of migrants continue to cross the southern Hungarian borders heading for Western Europe. The long journeys of asylum seekers include dangerous crossings of seas or rivers, sleeping rough in cold and heat, and abuse by people smugglers. According to the Missing Migrants Project, more than 25,000 people have gone missing in the Mediterranean alone since 2014. Why take such risks? Refugees from Afghanistan may be escaping. Those from Turkey, Iraq, and Syria may be fleeing. Economic migrants from Tunisia, Egypt, Bangladesh, Algeria, and Morocco are determined to reach the EU to escape poverty, for example, and living wages and build a better life. Yet the EU meets them all with walls, barbed wire, and filthy refugee camps. There is a precedent for solving migration issues with humane policies, not walls. Over 4.8 million Ukrainians, mostly women and children, have registered for the EU's Temporary Protection Scheme or other national programs, including over 1 million in Poland and Germany and over 100,000 in the Czech Republic, Italy, Spain and the UK, Bulgaria and France. The EU's Temporary Protection Directive allows these migrants to move freely between member states, gives them instant rights to live and work, and offers access to benefits like housing and medical care for up to 3 years. While migrants are a net cost in the short run, in the long run, they are taxpayers. Some will assimilate and settle in the EU, thus helping relieve its worker shortage and demographic crisis. Why not adopt the same policies for African migrants, for example? Governments can provide asylum seekers with temporary accommodation, legal pathways to obtain jobs, language classes, and modest financial support. Private companies can invest in human capital by training and hiring these workers. Once employed or in school, The young men, most of these migrants are young men, will pay taxes and productively contribute to the host society. The fears that natives lose jobs to migrants are largely overstated because migrants tend to take less desirable jobs. Moreover, they create new jobs within and outside diaspora communities. In other words, groups of migrants in host countries who have come from the same original culture. If people in host countries are worried about an excess of young male migrants, the EU can design a merit migration system to welcome families with young children. Local diasporas and personal sponsors can be asked to support new migrants and bear some responsibility for their housing, language training, and employment. With more support and mentoring available, migrants will be better able to assimilate into the EU culture. There are some hopeful signs. The new Slovenian government is removing a 143-kilometer razor-wired border fence with Croatia, built during the 2015 to 2016 refugee crisis due to its ineffectiveness. Let's hope that other countries will follow suit and use the lessons of regulated migration of Ukrainian refugees to address the problem of other migrants in Europe and beyond.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about some of the Islamic rules or laws concerning the different types of water according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
Little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about different types of water and their Islamic laws according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. Sheikh Javid, let me ask you this question at the beginning of this episode. You know, to purify an impure item of clothes in water, whatever.
Yes.
It may be, whether it is the cold water that you want to, you know, remove the impurity from it or the running water. Well, is it obligatory, is it necessary to squeeze the clothes inside the water, or you have to first take the clothes out of the water and then wring it out?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, His Eminence Ayatollah Khamenei, may Allah grant him long life, says that it will suffice to wring the clothes out or shake them inside the water. It is sufficient, and obviously it is better, it's better to wring the clothes out of the water because sometimes, of course, you know, wringing doesn't make sense because you want to, you know, force the water out and by squeezing it and make sure that there's no water left. And when you squeeze it inside the water, then there will still be some water left in the cloth. So it's better to wring it out of the water, but mm-hmm. of course it will be sufficient to squeeze it or wring it out or even shake it inside the water, according to His Eminence.
Uh-huh, I see. Okay, thank you very much. Another question would be related actually to the running water or the tap water. In order to purify an impure carpet or anything like it, is it enough, Sheikh Javi, to apply or to use the tap water for that impure area only? We all know that usually the tap water is connected to the city pipes.
Sure.
All right?
Yes.
Well, so is it enough to apply the tap water to that najis area, or should the used water be extracted as well?
Well, this is a very frequently asked question. You know, a lot of families have problem with their carpets, and some of them cannot even remove the carpets because it's glued to the floor.
Yes.
And this makes a problem.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, some people live in wooden houses and they cannot use water. So these are different, mm-hmm. there are different problems.
Yes.
When it comes to, you know, purifying a carpet, His Eminence actually says that after applying piped water or the water which comes from the tap, after applying this water, removal of the used water is not necessary. So it's not actually important or necessary or wajib to make sure that there is no water left. It's not necessary basically to remove the water when pipe water is made to flow and spread on the najis carpet. So it can remain there,
mm-hmm.
and the carpet will be purified. And His Eminence also says that after the, of course, it's very important that the inherently najis object should be removed first. There shouldn't be any najis object seen or visible on the carpet. Of course, it should be removed first of all to make sure that, you know, there is no najis or impure substance left on the carpet.
Mm-hmm.
And after it is removed, then water, should be the pipe water or the tap water should be made to flow on the carpet. And when water reaches all the area, all parts of the najis carpet, of course, and the used water has been, after it has been removed from the carpet, then it's not necessary, of course, to press it with your hand, okay,
mm-hmm.
To make the water, you know,
come out
of the carpet. So it's not necessary. You just need to simply
apply the water.
Yeah, apply the water and try to, you see, make the water flow out,
mm-hmm.
if as far as possible.
Yes.
But it's not necessary to squeeze it or to press the carpet with your hand to make sure that there's no najis water left. So because the tap water, it's very important. We are not using little water,
yes.
or qalil water. We are using, for example, tap water, which is considered to be cool according to the religious authorities.
Mm-hmm.
It's not running water because it's...
You mean as long as the impure substance is not there, color is not there, the smell is not there, it's pure.
It is pure.
Yes.
Of course.
After applying the water,
of course. When we talk of smell, we don't consider all smell to be, you know, to be, for example, making the water impure. You know, sometimes the water may give the smell of the carpet.
Right.
And not the smell of urine or something
exactly.
like that. So that doesn't mean that there mm-hmm. is still smell and, of course, the carpet is najis. No. If it gives the smell of something other than najasa, it doesn't mean that it's najis.
Mm-hmm.
It is pure, actually.
Right, right. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about different types of water and their Islamic laws according to Ayatollah Khomeini's fatwas. Well, Sheikh Javid, let me ask you this question. This might be a frequent one. In order to make a wudu, let's say, all right,
Or
let me put it this way, or rephrase my question. What is the rule of wudu or ghusl? Made with the water hard by nature or thick by nature, basically. Yes. All right. Some water, like the seawater, for example, is thicker than normal, or the tap water, the purified water that we get through the, running through the city pipes.
Sure.
Right.
Yes.
I'm talking about that kind of water with a lot of, for example, salt, like the water from the lakes or the seawater. So what's the rule of the wudu made by that kind of water?
Okay. Well, the mere hardness of the water due to the presence of salt does not actually prevent it from being considered as unadulterated, water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the criteria by which the Shari application of unadulterated water comes into effect is that the water must be regarded as such in common view. So common view is very important. If in common view the water is considered to be unmixed and it's considered to be pure and unadulterated, it is enough. You know, mm-hmm. even if it is, for example, when you test it, it tastes saltish. Like, for example, most of the, of course, all of the water in the sea and also oceans are actually salty. And they are still purifying because we see that in the Islamic tradition, there are reports to the effect that the noble prophet, peace be upon him, and also his companions, they considered the water from the sea,
mm-hmm.
Flowing from the sea, or the water in the oceans as pure.
Right.
And so, even though it is salty, the taste is not normal, and people cannot drink it. But then it can be used for purification, like, for example, making wudu and performing ghusl, and there's no objection to it. Because in common view, it is considered to be water. It's considered to be unadulterated.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I see. So what you're saying is that regardless of its density, the density of the salt or any other minerals, as long as it's the water from the sea or the lakes, it's okay. It's purifying.
It's purifying, yes.
Uh-huh. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice comments and answers to these questions regarding the different types of water and the Islamic laws about them according to the fatwas made by Ayatollah Khamenei. Thank you very much, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. From me and the rest of the crew, we say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.